Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. It's great to be with you again. And as you know, this is our final seminar. And I mentioned a couple of times that we'll have an additional amount of time. I wanted to add on some time at the end for us to have a discussion, more question and answers. And I have received some amazing questions and sophisticated observation. I wish I knew the answers, but most of you know that not knowing has never stopped me from talking. I've been able to put into a composite some of the questions into maybe three or four representative ones, but I really appreciate how much you've given thought and consideration to what we've talked about and the sophistication of the questions and the challenges that you presented are really tight and focused and excellent. So I look forward to that discussion and look forward to further input. But at the beginning now, what other things would be helpful to talk about or touch on first? Any clarifications from any of the first three seminars that you wanted to address or just to revisit? I had one email that wanted just a brief review of what we talked about as self-directed neuroplasticity. It's something simply that we can do to address negative self-talk or recurring obsessional ideas, things that come into our mind unwanted, unwelcome, but seem intrusive. Or just simply a negative self-talk, like I can't do it. And Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, he's a neuropsychiatrist at UCLA. We've collaborated about some stuff. He's been in my mastermind group. A couple of you have heard him in that context. He developed the concept of self-directed neuroplasticity. It's three simple steps: to recognize first, as quickly as possible, let's say negative self-talk. Whenever you've repeated something enough, it's going to hardwire, and that's your brain doing its job description to do what comes automatically. So as soon as you hear something that you don't want, negative self-talk, for example, recognize it and label it simply as an error message from your brain. It was tailor-made for an earlier situation or at an earlier time in some way, but it's repeating now. So recognize it as an error message from your brain. Then refocus on right now, here and now, what you want, and reframe to look at what's the opportunity, what's the challenge, what's the possibility here, the kind of things we focus on in coaching. That kind of reframing boots up an entirely different mindset of possibility of creating new neuronal networks and pathways than engaging a problem, which only etches it further, as we talked before. So I hope that more succinct way of describing it is something that's helpful, because you're going to hear that with many, many clients about the things that automatically they say to themselves or in some way repeat that they will need to engage simply to have a system. Now, another part, just a little bit, you know, a 20-foot version of that, just move to not even a wide-angle lens, but just a little bit further away, a system that will help to be grounded and centered is simply a 2-minute mindfulness meditation. And when that's done regularly, it becomes more grooved and more a way of getting grounded and centered to really reflect on and use all of the information from all states of mind. So I hope that was helpful, and thanks for that prompt. What else? Anything else you'd like to discuss before we move into the material? There was one other comment that I wanted to just briefly address about how can we as coaches best engage participation and minimize opposition. Well, if you're asking a question, there's nothing to oppose. If you're given information, someone is, and this is the way our brains work, we will immediately decide whether we believe it or not, because we log into that belief system that's an anatomical reality in our brain to see if it fits with what we believe. If it fits, if the new information that we hear fits with what we believe, we're going to find ways to validate it. If it doesn't fit with what we believe, we're going to immediately seek to invalidate it in some way. So asking a question, as opposed to giving ideas, information, facts, asking a question will shift a listener's perspective to one of participant of looking for answers together rather than focusing on a position to oppose. Once somebody picks an answer, they're more likely to act consistently with that answer, which is what we do when someone commits to something. They want to follow through on the image they have of themselves to be consistent, so they're more likely to follow through. And asking is more likely to change someone's mind and to inspire endorsement and participation than telling. And remember, we've talked before, and this is all review totally, we commit to that which we help co-create. So think about another application, whether somebody's dealing with a terrorist or a suicide threat. The hostage negotiator begins with asking how the person is, to make it about the person rather than about the negotiator. A demand or command or statement makes it about the speaker, not the recipient. Asking a question to engage the thinking of the client or the player creates a collaborative alignment then with the client as point of reference, because what that person thinks matters. When it matters, they're going to be more committed. So that's the initial collaborative framework that we engage. At least that's what the terrorist and suicide threat people on the shows I watch do. Other thoughts or other questions, other things it might be helpful to talk about briefly before we move into the material and later the discussion, and I'll start with the questions that were already sent in. Mike, you had a comment. You were going to add either at the beginning or the end. Is this a good time?
If it's a good time for you, Dave, sure.
Go for it.
You know, the only observation that I shared with you and I offered to everybody is, you know, what I gleaned from this entire lecture series is a kind of a three-domain approach to things as coaches. And you've talked about identity as sort of one domain, and you've talked about this unlived life, or what I kind of gravitate to as essence, as another domain. And then the third domain, which you just touched on, is kind of our self-image. And I think what I've really taken away from this at this point is, when we go through change, those three domains, are circles that are disconnected. And sometimes our role as a coach is to take that change and see how it help our clients see how it impacts identity, how it impacts their essence, and how their self-image can maybe prove to be an obstacle in the change. And I think the more that we can bring those three circles together, they may not perfectly overlay each other, but the more that we can get the overlap, I think the sense that I get is the more comfortable the change becomes, the more open that our clients become to accepting that change and pivoting off of it, and the more flowful that change becomes, and the more harmony they take away from the entire change process.
Mike, could you just in a succinct sentence or two bring that alive and illustrate how you might do that with a client?
You know, what I see is, the identity, I would quiz them a little bit about...
Just what would you say, just in a succinct sentence or two, to a client to be a catalyst for that process that you're describing?
What is it that you are doing that fits with how you want to live your life? And what can you now do? You caught me a little bit off guard with that to succinctly put it together. But
those are two important questions, and I want to highlight each. because there are different answers, but one leads into the other, and I think they're excellent questions to look at assessing and then look at what's next. So I think that's a perfect answer from what you've been saying to apply in a very meaningful way for engagement. Now, I know I interrupted you. Was that basically what you wanted to convey?
That's exactly it. You know, how do we get the client to actually see what their obstacle is and to find the action to overcome it?
And that's why the first part is such a good question, because the client doesn't know yet, and we may not know yet. And this is not a scratch and sniff. You just ask the right question, and boom, there's going to be the answer, because the answer is going to be evolving and co-created as we go along. That's what makes it so powerful. Now, we're leading, but we're not leading toward an answer or about content, but we're a catalyst to help the reflective process, the process of self-reflection, self-examination, because that's what's going to stick. That's the legacy that we have, that the client will take for the rest of their lives to develop that self-reflection and the ability to examine themselves and what they do and to be more and more objective about it. At the same time, they're more subjectively aware, more empathic with themselves. So it's a terrific process and a great encapsulation of so much of what we do in coaching. So thanks. Did you really get to finish your did you get to overcome
you
my input and finish your thought?
That was perfect.
Okay. Super. All right. Thanks. Thank you very much. It's a great point. Other thoughts, questions, anything to talk about just briefly before we move into our final topic? Okay, well, we'll remember, jot down anything you'd like to talk about. We'll come back and have more of an open mic discussion at the end. I'm going to put us on lecture mode right now. I want to talk about some specific challenges and opportunities in the whole transition process. Practicing professionals, for example, healthcare, financial, legal, have in common, they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise. This expertise is to solve problems and give specific advice. It's backed by professional standards, laws, and codes. Even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, professionals probably have not been trained to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, to remove stress as an obstacle to their success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional expertise and advancement, to convert from work ethic to performance ethic, perhaps, and to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions. They'd assumed, as I did, they do one thing, the profession they train for all their lives. Now, I'm simply using this as an illustration, the examples of practicing professionals to look at transition niche coaching. Another genre, performance professionals, actors, professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success. In addition to the immersion in deliberate practice, another place that I see this challenge is the retirement transitions for pro athletes and actors. Here's what we can all learn about the importance of self-regulation for loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths, the points or the play immediately following a really intensely contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to be in a weakened aftermath. The winner is excited about the victory, and this may carry over into affecting the next play. The loser is frustrated, which also can carry over into errors or trying too hard. These aftermath point and plays are likely to be lost on errors, unforced errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively and with full concentration. And I'm using the term player for client, for protege, for colleague, anyone for the subject of this. Here's an example. The announcers at a Texans game on defensive lineman Casey, that's so often the case with young players. One good play, then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle, on the next play, the rookie Casey was offsides. Clearly an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt, the excitement from really making a good play. Now, success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, yet tomorrow's the next day. Your next career, and everyone I'm talking to right now, has gone through a career transition. Your career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything that you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own. Additionally, people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of transition are ones whose process begins with significant, maybe abrupt, loss, job, relationship, disability, divorce. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. Notice here, and this is a margin note, notice I'm wanting to think with you about some potential applications in your coaching practice, maybe even niche, of applying this information that we've been talking about. For example, the significance of emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management create challenges like making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of the divorce and not making it about the emotional factors that can derail logic and judgment. Guess who's best at that? The professional coach. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. A place that I see this is in coaching family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company, founded 34 years ago, to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge. Everyone involved changes roles, relationships, job descriptions, responsibilities. Here's another perspective. I've done a series of retreats with a good buddy and colleague called What's Next Exec for current senior executives and CEOs or business owners who are within a year or so of retirement. It's designed to help them create an informed and masterful transition to their next contribution or career. The executives and business owners at this retreat, with all pre-screened to be like 1 year, within a year of retirement, they know they're not going to be happy playing golf every day, or that it'll last a couple of months and then they're going to be looking around. And they know or have some idea, at least they've been supported and surrounded by a corporate structure, if they want to do something on their own, like consulting, like coaching, anything about setting and collecting professional fees. They know that they have not created their own structure to have any clue about how to do that, including marketing. You know much of what they're going through, many of you. You had never had to market your services, set up a PayPal account, establish a business name, or find somebody to do a website. So in this instance, retired is not an identity. It's the lack of one. The next job is looking at the transition itself and what's next. So think about this in a broader way. I'd like to pause for just a moment and have you think about this question. What do your clients really want from you as a professional coach? Maybe write it down if you have a phrase or a thought. The coach and client become co-authors of a new story and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus new in evolving that new story. And we're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back to her out loud. Remember, 90 to 95% of our operating systems are unconscious. So much of what needs to be dealt with, and I'm going to come back to this in a discussion of a couple of excellent questions that you guys have sent in. So we must be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or let our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continually need to bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story, their own. So here are some things that I think about and want to offer for you just to consider about what I think our clients want from us as coaches. I believe what our clients want from us as coaches is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unselfconscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Acceptance of praise without our embarrassment or deflection so we can give it back to its creator as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings. Never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we as coaches will see the self the client hopes to become, and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. Someone once said for me, "Kruger, I want you to stick up for the part of me that doesn't even know it yet." And I said, "That's a deal." To see at times a thought, a feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. I got that from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result. To see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process. To validate their intuition so that they can even more so. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in his or her process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story. We know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's still like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there a long time. The client mourns the self left behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. "I'm astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea." We are in the present moment together and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding in the present moment, may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. Likely the most. I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process, continuing in its influence throughout life. I've been occasionally heard to say, I'm going to be your coach for life, but I don't think regular meetings will be necessary except for a short period of time. In other words, they know that I'm going to be here, and if something comes up, either for celebration or for understanding a struggle, that's a single session in the future that we don't have to start all over. Intervals maybe of quarterly updates, maybe at least once a year, can be beneficial for both coach and client, kind of like booster shots. Witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is, does it work? We're going to come back to that in the discussion, so put a little asterisk there. Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become aware. Let's say it this way. We help people become more of who they really are. And the client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange, the risk, must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself, and empathically resonant with the full experience of the client. Hemingway captured this principle, I believe, when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. So, as we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, how we can look together at important storylines. How are you taking care of yourself? I want to come back to this in just a moment. I even ask clients how often they work out. And we're going to discuss your wellness story. How are you honoring your needs and ideals, your relationships? Or have you created something now that seems to be controlling you? And then we kind of wonder, maybe sometimes out loud, how are you framing yourself? By your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. The little bit more may be a nudge, a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, to contemplate, or celebrate. So, I've distilled into 12 principles how we facilitate change in coaching, in the coaching relationship. This is not a how-to, but it's a reflection. One, each person's life story is created. It's not a given. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Notice in that one sentence how I worked in the four first steps of the roadmap. Two, Understanding begins with examination of which storylines work and which don't. That's what we do in coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, do something else. And if it works, probably enhance it. 3, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. And you've heard me say this in this series before, and I got this and got total endorsement for plagiarizing him way back in the day when I had an adult service on the addiction unit. One of my old codger alcohol counselors used this with his patients, and it worked so well. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. And that's the cleaned up version. 4, distinguish what to change, accept, let go, and enhance. Put energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go what can't be changed, can result in significant effectiveness. We're going to return to that in the discussion. When people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. 6, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to fit with and sustain a new story. 7, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are, at least initially. So we learn to recognize our own assumptions and beliefs, how they color what's perceived. Assumptions are manifest usually as feelings and behaviors. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere can both be scrutinized. 8, change is constant and inevitable. It's resistance to change that generates most problems. You've heard me say that before in this series. People are more successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. If someone's protesting change, they've already engaged it. 9, small changes lead to big changes. For example, professionals can get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively in the next hour. This exercises effectiveness and initiates a model for effectiveness and the experience of mastery. 10, solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to align the client's needs and ideals, to strategize toward the client's goal, to create a map, a system. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically and systematically pursue goals. 11, a collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side, looking at the same scene together. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what's positive will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental often results in a defensive action. And 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't will become evident and self-perpetuating. And again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade has probably forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated of how they can work with their clients, their patients, their colleagues. So let's focus for just a moment, speaking of change and transition, perhaps, about your wellness story. A significant aspect of change and transition process is to build a wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. And with this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you got a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew from the beginning you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil, motor, do everything possible for maintenance, knowing it will be the only car for the rest of your life. You'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. As Bessel van der Kolk wrote a book in the 90s, it's back to the New York Times bestseller list, your body keeps the score. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. Wellness is an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it needs to consistently, I believe, be assessed. Wellness is not something you began to plan at age 65 or 50, but every choice you make every day writes your wellness story. Now, our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. Let's say you decide to grab a few peanut M&Ms out of the candy bowl. That's not ever caused a heart attack, no big deal. But you take in 100 calories more each day than you burn. In 1 year, you gain 9 pounds. It also goes the other way. So our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion or just simply disregard. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. Now, this has taken a while, because health is biologically way more complex than disease. So here's something I want to leave you with for this focus. It was something I became aware of when the internist who had devoted 35 years of his professional life to wellness research, an internist in New York City, and I first became aware of his work when we presented at a similar venue and got a chance to know each other. And this is a book that I have recommended again and again to clients. It's called Younger Next Year, and the companion book, Younger Next Year for Women. It's Henry Lodge, Jr. He says that 70% of aging is not aging but decay. If we assume that ailments and deteriorations are a normal part of growing old, that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. Another story is that this is largely optional. Decay and functional aging are largely optional. The alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. A new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. This is from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And that was written over a decade ago. The new wellness story, a central storyline of exercise, no negotiation, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Dr. Lodge, in his spectacular research, in my view, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. He emphasizes that 4 of those 6 days of exercise needs to be serious aerobic exercise the rest of your life. Biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay, and blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Now, of 3,000 people surveyed, and this has been repeated with larger numbers, same findings. Three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. More than anything else, people put off exercise, nutritional plan, and retirement plan. Now, here's something that he found. When we exercise, this was first in a lab, that exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus by 100%. And the hippocampus is the site of creativity and memory. This was done first repeatedly in laboratory animals and repeated more recently, London taxicab drivers, University of Hamburg medical students, that creativity, which is what we do in coaching, we've touched on this, and exercise significantly enhances the hippocampus. Chronic stress, it goes the other way. So this is, I think, something that is important, that creativity and exercise both create neurogenesis, the making of new cells. Chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. Now, here's a final study I want to mention that I've just alluded to before, but how we see our future selves can be very important. The prototype study in this regard was by Princeton psychologist Emily Pronin, who found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money people put toward retirement, depends on how closely we identify with our future selves. When someone can envision their future selves in the distant future, in their 70s, 80s, 90s, they save about 3 times as much as people who don't or can't. And similarly, there have been some replication of this study by computer-enhanced aging to show that when someone is helped to visualize, it can increase saving. It can, by looking at progression with smoking or without smoking, help someone to stop smoking because, or with weight gain. Think about that 100 pounds, that 100 calories a day and 9 to age progression will show you what will happen if you stay on the same trajectory or if you change. So, think about the difference between people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and direction, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. By contrast, those who accomplish and believe have a different story they're creating, and they embody that story in their lives for themselves and others. Their story within, their plot, guides them and orients them in a script that they consciously write. Now, throughout these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapters of their life or their business stories. So, think about your immediate response to these questions right now. Not, you know, I think they're an outline, but think about the response. You, right now. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would the title be? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what will that be? Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. Just jot down the incident and perhaps come back later to fill in the story of that incident and that scenario. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? What events or process recently foreshadows your next success? And think about this more significantly than an immediate response. What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And think about this question as a final one. What is your spiritual essence? Remember, you don't have to be religious to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. So, I want to conclude with the life stages of success. You'll hear the secrets. A final exercise, three applicable quotes, and a brief story from yesterday's New York Times that says we've been on the right track with these four seminars. Okay? Let me see if I can get it. The life stages of success. Now, this moves beyond the wide-angle lens that we pulled out a little bit earlier to time-lapse photography. Success may mean different things at different points in your adult life at each developmental phase. Here's how it may look in a relationship. And I want to just summarize. These are some of the quotes that could summarize it way more succinctly than I ever could. Here's how Ruby Dee in I Dream a World put it about how it may look in a relationship. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. That's a real appreciation of the developmental significance of a life. And we're going to come to a brief discussion of the developmental phases in a coaching relationship in our discussion, I think. So once you achieve, say, monetary success, professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important, ideally before, and you'll be even more successful. A caveat, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective from my favorite essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you, and a few of you have done this, but do it again and see what happens this time, okay? Get in a very comfortable and relaxed position in your seat. Be aware of how fully and securely your seat is holding you. Close your eyes, relax your body. Take a deep breath in for relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Another deep breath in for relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Keep your eyes closed and listen just to my words. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change or even a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might not have really seen right, that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risks that you should have taken or shouldn't have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look very carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. And three important quotes as conclusions. These are not necessarily about change and transition, but at the same time, it's everything about the engagement to produce superb change and transition. The first, many of you have heard this before, from my favorite grandmother. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. From my favorite athletic coach, repeatedly. Your mind is the most powerful thing in the world. And from my son, Ryan, no backstory necessary here, we always make time for what's really important. Now, aligned with when you're ready to learn, a teacher will appear, I want to close by reading two brief paragraphs to summarize what we've been discussing in our four seminars that appeared in yesterday's New York Times in an article by Emily Estefani Smith. Several hundred years ago in Japan, artisans developed a way to mend shattered pottery known as kintsugi, in which they glued together the broken shards of ceramic with lacquer and dusted the lacquer's exposed surface with gold or silver powder. The seams of gold or silver that held the fragments together made the vessel distinct and radiating with beauty. Kintsugi was later embraced outside Japan as a philosophy for living. Bad things that can happen, that can shatter us. But we don't have to stay broken or hide our wounds. We can put ourselves back together. And the scars we wear at the broken places become a reminder of the tragedies we've endured and how we overcame them. A mark of beauty in an imperfect life. And my own addition to that as a summary. And like the pottery, stronger than before. Okay, what would be most helpful for us to talk about? I can start with some of the questions that have been sent in, but anything more immediately, hot off the presses that would be helpful to talk about right now from this session, perhaps, or other things that you really would like to talk about first. Thank you for all of you who have sent in questions and comments. It's been really an amazing number of people and questions. I mean, we could have a whole other course just on the questions you've sent in. These are excellent questions, and I see how much you've been thinking and engaging along to ask them. Anything right now anyone would like to offer or ask or just add before I start on the questions that I want to attempt to discuss with you, not just tell you, but with you about what you've sent in and those of you who have sent in the question, don't hesitate to interrupt me when I do. So anything for right now? Okay, you guys are going to make me still work, okay? All right, here's the first question. And I'm just going to start with these, and then you guys are going to have to work some, too. I want to open it up to hear more from you. Question, and again, I've condensed as much as possible but kept the spirit of the original question. How can the concept of old story and new story and letting go to have a new beginning impact when there's still a continuing focus on problems, victimization, or mistreatment? Besides awareness, is there value in fully exploring the past, or does that keep us living in the past story? And how much do external realities play in our ability to transition? That was one of the first questions sent in by Neva about the reality of navigating the external reality. So this is a great question, an important one. Now, we discussed the first three steps of the roadmap system to recognize, own, and assess a story, the awareness of what is. Now, this does not imply going back into the old story to understand it better, to work it through, to understand the dynamics, or to solve problems that have already occurred in the past. Beyond awareness, stopping to understand the old story is just another way of stopping. Now, here was my initial introduction to professional coaching while practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis. That's where I trafficked in old stories. Understanding, working through, coming to the end of the past does not create a model or a map for a successful new story. That's what we address. That's our specialty, the choice architecture of here and now. So I believe we can best help by reframing problems, limitations, and stuckness into questions about challenge, opportunity, or possibility. And remember, the frame determines how we proceed. It boots up mindset to engage the question. To pursue a problem goes down an existing pathway, an already existing pathway in the brain, etching it further. Even though we think we're creating different and better answers, it still recreates the process of engaging the problem. To engage possibility, that's a here and now creation of the beginning of new neuronal networks and connections in the brain. It activates the brain in a different way. It creates a different mindset. Now, the external realities are an important component that we have to recognize and at least resonate with without reentering the past to do so. Think about how we have each dealt with an abundance of these realities. Look at the last 18 months. So, as you know, external realities include everything from blind spot, well, this is internal in part, blind spots, conscious and unconscious biases, limiting beliefs. This is where we move into the extra microaggressions, dealing with those broader examples like the pandemic, issues of critical race theory, the white racial frame. So we look for opportunities to reframe problems and limitations as possibility and opportunity. So a practical aspect may be to have a principle in mind that Stephen Covey described, and this is going to be something that I believe you're going to find or probably already do for a really big number of your clients. The circle of influence and the circle of concern, not in those terms, but just the practical. The circle of concern is all the things you're concerned about and would like to change, but have absolutely no power to do so, at least immediately. This ranges from at least immediately, global warning, to how you'd like your partner or your boss to respond. The circle of influence is everything that you can be effective in determining. This usually ends at the level of your skin. In coaching some someone, we can help them at times to recognize the distinction of what they can do something about and be effective at and what they can't, in order to let go of what they can't determine, because they'll be much less frustrated, much less energy if they continue to try to do that. So here's a case illustration that was another question that I think will give us a way to at least one perspective on that. And I received this just a couple of days ago. So highly summarized, it's this. I work with women who have experienced toxic relationships. My client recognizes her husband is narcissistic, and she's very clear she won't ever leave him, but instead wants to work on herself to become stronger and become the perfect wife for him so that he'll stay and not cheat again. She is, and this is still from the coach, she is still clinging onto the hope that if she becomes his dream wife, he will change. Do you have any suggestions as to how I can keep elevating her mindset to become stronger mentally and emotionally? We worked together for 8 weeks now. Now, my response begins with this. Our mentors and our coaches may come in likely but sometimes unlikely place. Here's a question from Dr. Phil for this client. How's that working for you? The process here is of the client focusing on her husband's response, hoping that he will become an extension of her interest and her desire, and then she'll be happy if he responds in the just right way, and that will change the relationship. It's not her mindset that's not working. It's her assumption. This is the application of distinguishing between what she can determine and what she can't. Remember, whatever you think, feel, and experience is what you create each moment. And whatever you experience, you either create or accept. She's accepting something that she hasn't quite recognized and owned that she's accepting, but keeps inhabiting the story that if she just does it right, then he's going to change, or he's not going to do some things. A Dutch uncle framework here would be to gently help her recognize that her assumption and behavior has become a central organizing factor for her life. That, by the way, is the definition of an addiction, when a story takes over the author. So I believe this case illustrates how we sometimes create contingencies to rationalize or postpone the initiation of the new or the challenging. A contingency makes it seem acceptable or understandable and become a sufficient reason not to proceed until it's taken care of. But it only serves as a stopping point. I really need to organize my office before starting on the book. I need to take care of some correspondence before I start my own new marketing project. Well, I'll wait until I have time without interruption before starting my tax preparation. Now, guess why each of these sounded so natural and so practiced? Reasons to postpone eating healthier, exercising more, or initiating a new and challenging task create a justification by establishing an obstacle to immediate action. This can produce immediate reduction of anxiety or dissonance or closure and make it seem totally logical and sufficient reason not to proceed because of the obstacle. But remember, the obstacle's not there until you create it. Show me an obstacle, I'll show you a desire. Now, I have some other questions, but I'm really interested in what you're thinking and how you're hearing this and what you'd like to talk about live time here.
Hi, this is Yusuf Wilson. How are you doing? Doing a great job.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good. Okay, two really areas that jumped out that were really impactful and insightful was even your discussion right now when you talk about the circle of concern versus the circle of influence. I actually leveraged those topics in exactly those ways in terms of labels to work with customers and work with clients that where we talk about the things that we can influence and the things we can't, as well as where we need to, you know, basically put our execution focus at. So I think that was so spot on. One question I did have when you go from the old story to the new story is that for me, I find it a challenge to navigate that thin line when I have clients that want to turn it into a deep therapy session versus actually a problem solving and execution session where we're really, you know, looking at moving into action now versus doing a whole therapeutic process that we're trying to uncover and solve things from the past. And my question
okay,
to you
if we
would
have,
be,
if we have an objective of 45 seconds and you be that client and I'll be you, can you succinctly present that and I'll respond in a way to bring it alive and make it hopefully practical so you can see if it would be effective?
Absolutely. The big one is that, you know,
you be the client, not to explain it, but you be the client.
Oh, okay.
Beginning with
okay.
I'm the coach, and I have asked for your permission if I could interrupt you, as I do with every client, in case it would be helpful for us to consider something at the moment. So we've developed an alliance. We're collaborating. You know I have your best interest at heart. Go. Okay?
Okay. Well, I want to move on this, but my parents have, you know, dampened my, you know, self-esteem and effectiveness. So, you know, they've called me a loser.
May I interrupt you here
okay.
as a sidebar before I ask my question? How old are you?
Oh, me as a client or me as a practitioner?
No, the client here. We're talking about the client.
Oh, I got you. 45 years old. Say 45.
Okay. Now, when you say your parents determine how you feel, I think it's important for you to take ownership of that you determine whatever you think and feel and experience. So what would that be from this moment, considering how you want to craft your immediate experience?
Well, that's my problem, because I've been taking ownership
okay.
of my life. And
now, I
want to
interrupt
so
you. I want to interrupt you because you told me why you can't answer my question. And if you identify it as a problem, it makes it less likely to change. So I'm asking you not to tell me about the problem, but to tell me in this moment, what will you do differently to create in this moment a different story? In one sentence, summarize that for me.
Perfect. Okay, cool.
Keep being that client. I want to hear what's next.
Oh, okay. Well, my action would be I need to take responsibility.
Okay.
Right now.
Well, I don't know what that means. Let's look at one step that you will commit to do that would be for you a new step and progress. Be specific.
Okay. All right. I will begin to contact people on LinkedIn for networking and building my network instead of complaining about how I don't have people to work
okay.
with.
How many people will you contact by when?
5 to 8 per week.
Okay. When you hang up the phone, how many will you contact today?
I will at least try to reach out to 2 because
okay. One of the great philosophers of the 20th century said, try not, do or do not. There is no try. That was Yoda. How many will you do and commit to do today?
2.
Okay. Will you commit to do that number each day or more?
Yeah, I'll do at least 2 per day.
Okay. I hear a new story. I don't hear going back into the familiar network in your brain of the problem, because when you talk about a problem, you don't got to do nothing. You don't gotta reach out to anybody. You are at home and dancing that same dance with the same problem. So it's stuckness, but it keeps you in the same place. You're walking that same pathway in the snow that everybody else has walked, that you've walked hundreds and hundreds of times before. So does that make sense to you about what we do in coaching? Where we focus is not about understanding and dynamics and history and all of that, but the choice architecture of this moment, so that when your client hangs up the phone, sure, he knows exactly what he's going to do next, and if he really wants to change, we'll co-create with you a system to do that, not just an objective, certainly not going backwards into a problem or forward into an abstraction, but a system. And that system's not going to feel comfortable, and I fail to resonate with how uncomfortable it probably is for you to make a commitment to do something different, how uncomfortable it's going to feel going forward, or to look at maybe how we can celebrate what you do when you do it, because all that's part of a new system. We do what we do because we imagine how we're going to feel when we do it. So that's going to feel different, uncomfortable in the beginning, but different overall. So thanks for that. I think this is going to illuminate some other things too, because this is a question that's kind of a composite, and it's such a good cross section of what we deal with. How can we best support a client when there's a disconnect between how they see themselves and how others see them? When those things are out of alignment, there are terrific challenges in general. Do you think there's anything coaching could do? Well, obviously, or I wouldn't have been bringing this question as one of the final ones. Okay, first, I would say that this is the best example of how I can think that we earn our money. When the process is recreated to bring alive the issue the client most needs to deal with, it's not a simple content. What we just did in that little laser coaching, that was a simple content. This is not, the question implies, it's not a single and simple content of focusing on what's next, creating a structure, clear, tangible, concrete steps. So here's a quick example of that process to maybe bring it alive a little bit more than the question. An individual was referred to me who was one of the six top executives at a large corporation. He had annoyed and alienated everyone in the executive suite. They were on the cusp of voting to release him. He was about ready, they were told, to leave. And then the suggestion was made by one of the executives, well, before he goes, let's give Kruger a shot. My client agreed. I agreed. Well, guess what? Immediately when he began our work, he began to annoy me in the same way as was described by the others he worked with. So here are the principles that I want to highlight. One, to put my ego in a blind trust. In other words, to not take what he said or did personally. To consider that he's doing the very best job possible to show me exactly what it's like to be him, to bring alive in the process the issue that he may not be able to see or understand or certainly address in a more effective way. My client was showing me in the best way he could what the issue was he most needed help with. That is, he was recreating in the process what he didn't know exactly how to objectively describe. So he showed me. Why? Because it's ingrained as an attachment, behavioral, and emotional pattern that's hardwired. I'll send you guys a white paper that applies this idea to coaching. I'll send that by at least in the morning. Because it's likely driven by that 95% plus of the operating of his operating system that's unconscious. So initially with any client, the first developmental phase of a coaching relationship and engagement is this, to develop a working alliance. What that means is that we co-create with a client the collaborative experience to totally invest in understanding a situation to evoke change, transformation, and success. Specifically, more immediately, what that means is the client knows that I'm all in for his success, so I can get away with that alliance, knowing that we're doing it together in a collaborative framework, that I can get away with saying whatever I need to say to him, and know he's not going to perceive it as critical or judgmental or pejorative. Not one of the executives, not one of his friends, nobody in his family could get away with that. So, how do you start to best do that? First, each of you draw a circle. Now, in that circle, draw a stick figure. That stick figure is your client. The best way for you to get inside the circle so your client will listen to you, which is the only place outside the circle, they're not going to listen to you. Your challenge is to get inside the circle so the client will listen to you so that you and the client collaboratively can create a common ground to go someplace new together. Your best bet is to resonate empathically with the client's experience to join together to create that common ground to proceed. State before strategy and story in that order. State always comes first. That's the empathic resonance. For my client, it was something like, you know, I understand how frustrating it must be for you at your company and the challenge of working with the other executives at times. He was frustrated. He was downloading that to everybody else and attempted to with me. Now, let's take a step back 30 paces. A framework of conversation and coaching is one of collaboration. Beginning at the same place and going someplace new. We know from neuroscience the first few words of a conversation boots up a neurochemical system, the mindset, that mediates the remainder of the conversation. If those first few words are perceived to be collaborative, then it's mediated by oxytocin, the chemical of bonding and connection. If those first few words, though, are perceived as judgmental or critical or oppositional, or simply just given facts, an entirely different neurochemical system is booted up, adrenaline and cortisol, that bring trust and caution and self-protection into the foreground. Now, having these ideas in mind establishes a framework of collaboration to really understand how to optimize performance and establish effective communication and collaboration at the same time. I knew that my client, as every client, was unconsciously taking notes of how and what we did to download as a model for how he could engage and interact with his colleagues, because he really actually didn't have a clue. He tried to think that giving them information was going to convert them. And I found that the higher up in the executive hierarchy you go, to CEOs, maybe physicians, the more basic understanding of the client's own dynamics and the dynamics of interacting with others becomes more important, because this has not been a component of their training experience. They've become accustomed to giving orders, to telling people what to do, and they do it. So they're accustomed to giving information. The new model that he was experiencing and incorporating was taken back into the executive suite and to his division for a significantly more effective functioning there. So use the right model. This is parallel to engaging the right mindset for any kind of endeavor or performance. And like we just discussed of creating a mindset of collaboration, it mutually explores from the same position. You and the client are aligned. So I hope that makes sense in an application that would be useful for you and your situation. I know we're a little bit over for what we initially talked about 15 minutes, but I want to be sure we cover anything that you're interested, for those of you who are still hanging around, interesting for us to talk about or that might be helpful for you. Anything else? What else?
I tell you what, can I get in one more question?
Sure.
Okay, great. Just one quick question logistically. How long will the recording stay live?
My understanding is that they are up for 30 days past the last seminar. So for 30 more days is my understanding.
Okay.
If I find out differently, I'll let you know.
That's it. Hey, you did a great job, and I want to thank you for all of your insight and guidance. Really top notch. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And, while you're at the CTA website, and this is something we recommend in CTA to get, if you can, a mentor coach. When I did my training, that was equally important as the actual training I did. You're going to see at the CTA website a list of our terrific faculty and their experiences and interests to see what may match. They each do individual mentor coaching. And I believe working with a mentor coach can be the best investment you can make. And it have an exponential on your return of investment for your practice. So whether you go in-house or outside CTA, whenever you can. You know, I've had over 15 years, I've had four different mentor coaches that have been specific for certain situations at certain times. The initial one was just the whole transition and transformation. As I mentioned, someone who had gone through something exactly like me. Other questions or comments? Anyone?
Dave, this is Federico. Your last point of your last point of your example of the rest of the course was great. Really appreciate that. Just a side point to what you mentioned. So what if your client comes with a transition story which is obviously practically unrealistic? Say if I tell you, oh, Dave, I decide to try out for the NFL in the next 5 years at the age of 50, not being fast. So what if something is so obvious?
Have you been listening in to my conversations with my mentor? No, go ahead. Okay, if there's something that's unrealistic?
Pretty unrealistic, obviously.
Okay.
You know, so how you start with your empathy and your understanding where the person's coming from, but how do you, at what point do you start hinting that transition is going to be a failure?
I wouldn't approach it that way. I want to understand more of how someone got to that position. You know, it's kind of like saying if your client immediately in the here and now goes from A to B to D, I don't know what happened to C, so I want to ask, help me understand how you're thinking about it to come to that conclusion. So I want to know what the client and how the client is thinking to come to that conclusion. Because if I engaged the conclusion, I'd be invalidated to fired. If the client, had any sense, they'd fire me. So I want to know the process so that we can engage the process and look at a way to systematically go about attaining their ideals and needs. Do that exercise in the resources section of your outline, because that's and that's probably the only exercise that I really ask a client to do at the beginning of a coaching engagement with any regularity. If you have in front of you the three top needs that that person has, the three top ideals, and that you ask them how they're thinking about it to come to that conclusion, you've begun an engagement that's very specific for that client and where that client is right now, so that you can collaboratively engage what it is they want and look at the process of how they're systematically going about it. Because it may not be to be in the NFL as they look at it more closely, but look at what's more realistic. But you don't, that's not where you began. You began with where they are, what they're wanting to do, and to help them get there in a more strategic and systematic way that aligns with their needs and ideals. And this is why I do that those two exercises initially, because sometimes someone's goals and strategies are counter to what their actual needs and ideals are. So there's a derailment very quickly, or they've already experienced it. So when needs and ideals align with strategies and goals, it's dynamite. All of them is going in the same direction. And by the time they're all going in the same direction, you're probably done in terms of coaching, because that's an objective, because they've internalized the process. So I hope that's helpful, Federico. Is that, does that really answer your question?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
Absolutely. Good. Good. Thanks. Okay. Anything else very quickly? I know we're over, and I appreciate you guys hanging around. Anything else that would be helpful to talk about just very briefly, or any other reflections or observations?
Thank you. It's been an amazing journey.
Thank you. And I wanted to thank each of you for all of the very kind words and feedback and questions and reflections that you've sent in. It's really helped guide me in making some comments and giving illustrations that would be maybe more experience near to some of the questions and illustrate those. It's been a privilege to work with you, and I'll be eager to hear how it goes for you. If I can help you in any way, please let me know. Thank you again for all of your energy, participation, feedback, in exchange. I've enjoyed it totally. Thanks very, very much. Bye now. Take good care of yourselves.
Thank you.
Absolutely.